All right. We're on lesson 4 out of 5. We've spent a few weeks getting to lesson 4. We started with, what does it mean to be a Christian? And what was the lens for what does it mean to be a Christian? How did we consider that question? I got to go back. The Apostles' Creed. Thank you. And we pretty much agreed that if you can affirm the doctrinal truths of the Apostles' Creed, you are a Christian. That is the baseline of what one needs to believe to consider themselves a Christian. And we went through that creed and looked, and hopefully we're a little bit surprised by just how much is in that short of a creed, by just how many theological affirmations are made when you say that relatively simple creed. Then we asked, what does it mean to be a Protestant? And what was the framework that we used for considering the distinction between Protestant and Roman Catholic? The five solas. Faith alone, grace alone, the Scriptures alone, Christ alone, the glory of God alone. And I flipped two of the middle ones there, it's early. The five solas are what we considered for what are the foundational differences between a Protestant and a Roman Catholic. What was the Protestant Reformation all about and why does it matter? The third lesson, we asked, what does it mean to be Reformed? Because within the Protestant world, you can make more distinctions, and one of the major distinctions is Reformed or non-Reformed. What do we use as our lens for considering what it means to be Reformed? Tulip. Total depravity, unconditional election, limited atonement, irresistible grace, and perseverance of the saints. And so through that lens, we began to understand what does it mean to be Reformed. That leads us to what does it mean to be Presbyterian. We started out with casting a huge net as we consider what does it mean to be a member of this particular church, Covenant of Grace, ARP. We started out with a huge net. Well, it means you're a Christian. Well, what does that mean? And then we focused it a little more. It means you're a Protestant Christian. It means you have a Reformed understanding of the Scriptures. And now it means that you believe Presbyterian form of government is the most biblical form of government. And we've talked all along about how when we were dealing with what does it mean to be a Christian, we were dealing with absolute non-negotiables. If you equivocate on the doctrines in the Apostles' Creed, properly understood, then you have a really hard time categorizing yourself as a Christian. We feel just as strongly, minus a half a degree, about the doctrines where we talked about what does it mean to be Protestant. Those are really, really essential doctrines for salvation, because at stake is whether or not salvation comes by grace through faith, or whether or not salvation comes by grace through faith plus something else. Then we talked about Reformed, where we said these are things that are very important to us. These are things that we believe are how you read the Bible properly. If you read the Bible faithfully with respect for both its literal nature and respect for context and genre, if you take God at His word and believe that the Bible is inerrant and infallible, you will come to a Reformed understanding of the Scriptures. And so we've said that that's very important. It's not to minimize that. But that's not the same level of importance as whether or not you affirm the Apostles' Creed. There are lots and lots of people who are not Reformed, who do not have a Reformed understanding of how God speaks in the Scriptures, who will inherit the kingdom of heaven. And so we needed to make that distinction. Now, as we move to Presbyterian, we make an even less important distinction. Now, is that to say it's unimportant? No. Does the type of church government you have matter? Yes, it matters both practically and theologically. But does the type of church government that you have affect your inheritance of the kingdom of heaven in the same way as your understanding of the doctrines of justification or the doctrines of sanctification? No, it's not the same level of importance. All of these things matter. Not everything matters equally. So we're on government. And we said last week that there are, big picture, 4 kinds of church government, 4 types. And those are on your handout there. And let's very quickly review them. What did we say is the basic premise of a Catholic model of church government. Remember, when we think about church governments, we're really answering the question, who has the placard on their desk that says the buck stops here? With each form of church government, the buck has to stop with somebody. And so the primary question we want to answer is, who does that buck stop with in each of these forms of government? So in Catholic, what's the answer to that question? The Pope, or the Bishop of Rome. And the reason I write Bishop of Rome rather than Pope is I want us to remember that the Roman Catholic Church is effectively an episcopal form of government, except that one bishop in the Roman Catholic Church is elevated above all of the other bishops. And so you have a very episcopal model until you get to that very last hierarchy of archbishops. And then in that hierarchy, rather than that group having the final say and the final authority, there is one bishop, the Bishop of Rome, we call the Pope, who has that authority. Within the episcopal model, it's going to be what we'll call the Council of Bishops. Same sort of model, where you have priests or pastors over an individual church. You have bishops over a geographical area. You might have bishops over multiple geographical areas. So you'll have a bishop of North Carolina, but you'll also have a bishop of the southeastern United States who's over all of those bishops. But as you work up through the hierarchy of bishops, eventually you will come to the top. You'll reach the last level. And in the episcopal model, it's that council, it's that group of archbishops that have the final say. There is no one Bishop of Rome that overrides all of them. Now, in this model, there is one administrative head of the church. There's one archbishop who's in charge of running the meetings, who's probably the public face, who speaks to the media in terms of being the representative in that way. But that is really no different than our sessions have moderators and our synods have moderators. It's the same type of thing. So that's the episcopal model. What did we say was the answer to the question with the congregational model? It's in the name. Who has the final authority in the congregational model? The congregation. Congregations can elect elders or deacons or deacon boards. They certainly hire pastors to make some decisions for them. But at the end of the day, every decision in every congregational church is ultimately subject to the will of that congregation. So they can elect a deacon board and say the deacon board is in charge of the building project. The moment the deacon board does something with respect to the building project that the congregation doesn't like, the congregation can call them in, undo the decision, and fire the deacon board. All power rests with the entire congregation. And that is with every voting member of a congregation. Which means that in a congregational church, every baptized child has an equal amount of authority as the pastor, the elder believers in the church. Everybody has equal vote. All right, the last model is the one that we practice here. And that's the Presbyterian model. And what's the answer to that question? Whose desk has the buck stops here placard? The session, or what we will write session, which is just what? A council of elders, right? So this was a council of bishops. This is a council of elders. And that's an important distinction because within the Presbyterian model, we're going to suggest that there are three offices in the church. There are deacons, elders, and ministers of the word. And depending on what branch of Presbyterian you're in, ARP, PCA, EPC, PCUSA, RPCNA, you go through the alphabet soup of Presbyterians, you may just say that there's two offices, deacons and elders. Some elders preach and some elders rule. I believe in the three office view. But within those three offices, everybody's equal. A minister of the word has no greater authority than an elder. And no one elder has any more authority than another elder. There are not these tiers of office. There's equal amounts of authority. So an elder in our church has as much authority in this church as he does in our presbytery when he goes and votes and represents our church, and is equal to all the other elders. There's no seniority. There's no hierarchy. An elder is an elder is an elder. That's different than a bishop who might be a bishop over North Carolina, who's not as powerful as the bishop who is over the Southeast, who's not as powerful as the bishop who's over the United States of America, who's not as powerful as the archbishop of whatever diocese. So both the ecclesiastical authority and the spiritual office is a difference between these two. Bishops are seen as a higher tier of eldership. So those are the things that we talked about with respect to those four offices. Another way to ask the question is this: when you think through church government, where can the church be found? How do you know that what you're dealing with is a church? You think, well, that's a weird way to think about a question, isn't it? Well, I'll tell you why that matters. In this model, I needed a different color, didn't I? In the Catholic model and in the Episcopal model, the church is whatever the institution says it is. So if these say that congregation is a true church, then it is. Where does the church get its authority? How can you know where the church is? In the Catholic model, it's because the Pope says so. So you want to know whether or not a church is a true church? All you got to do is ask him. Because he determines what is a church and what is not. Within the Episcopal model, it's the Council of Bishops. If they say it's a church, it is a church. In the congregational model, a congregation can determine this is a church. They decide, we want to plant a church, we want to start a church. We started a church, we're a true church. Church is started. The connecting thread between these three is that the type of government determines where the church is. The centralized government declares this is or is not a church. The church is found on the basis of whoever is in charge saying that's a church. So where does the church get its authority? It gets it from the bishop, it gets it from the council, or it gets it from the congregation. What's unique about the Presbyterian model is that we argue that it is not the government or the institution which establishes the church. It is Christ who establishes the church, and the church is not found where we say that's a church and that's not. The church is found wherever the marks of the church are present. There's three marks of a true church: faithful teaching of the Scriptures of God, the right administration of the sacraments, and the loving exercise of church discipline. And Presbyterians argue anywhere those three things are found is a church. Don't care if Baptist is on the door. Don't care what if Episcopal's on the door. Don't care if they haven't put anything on their door yet. Don't care if it's a bunch of people meeting in somebody's living room while they figure out what the next step is. If the marks of the church are present, the church, capital C, invisible church of Jesus Christ, is there. There is no institutional authority that makes something the church. You see what that distinction is all about? And in practice, congregational comes a lot closer to this. I mean, that really is generally what they would do. They would agree with most of what I just said. These two models think very differently. You're not a church until the church says you're a church. A little bit confusing there. The church is found wherever the marks of the true church are found. Let me make a quick case for Presbyterianism. I'm not going to go through the strengths and the weaknesses of all of these. I think they'll become evident throughout the discussion. But I do want to make a quick case for why we think Presbyterian is the most biblical model of church government. And let me... I'll say that for the end. That way I can offend you after you've listened to me. Better model. Think about the Old Testament. What we call the Mosaic economy, the time of Moses. God was dealing with His people in the Old Testament the same way He deals with His people in the New Testament, right? He was their God and they were His people, and He told them what to do and gave His law, and they were established by His grace and saved by faith in Him. At least on that point, the two testaments are consistent. How did God work through Israel in terms of church government? If you have to pick a model, what model do you see present in the Mosaic economy? Did Moses regularly summon the people all together and say, all right, we're going to take a vote, and those of you who want to leave Egypt, check the box on the right. And those of you who want to stay in bondage and slavery, check the box on the left. And whoever wins, that's what we're going to do, because this is a pure democracy here. When Moses came down the mountain and he found this idolatry going on with the golden calf, did he say, okay, everybody, let's take a vote. And if the golden calf wins, we'll worship the golden calf rather than Yahweh? No. He did let them choose sides, but it was who was going to live and who was going to die. It wasn't which God are we going to worship. So you do not see ever in the entire Old Testament a congregational model. Not once. You do not see it. What you also do not see, but you have to think through it a little more carefully, is a Catholic model. Because you might say, well, Moses was kind of that one representative person. The decisions all stopped with Moses. But is that true? What does the Old Testament refer to over and over and over again that Moses did? He gathered the elders. Remember 12 tribes? 12 elders? Yeah, this would be a good idea. You don't want all that power centralized in one person. You have a Presbyterian model in the Old Testament. Or you at least have one of these two. You have the idea of a group of people who are representatives of the congregation making the decisions. You do not have the entire congregation. You don't have pure democracy. But you also don't have the Catholic model either, where Moses says, this is how it's going to be. A couple exceptions to that are when God says to Moses, this is how it's going to be, now go do it. And then Moses would go do it. But as you look through the history of Israel, what you'll most often see in day-to-day practice in terms of how the temple was going to be run and how Israel was going to function and worship God was the council of elders would come together and they would make decisions. That's the Old Testament. What happens in the New Testament? Do you see a congregational model in the New Testament? Does Paul write to the Galatians and say, you foolish Galatians, don't you know that you ought to come together and take a vote on whether or not this faith plus works thing is the way that you want to go? And if the majority says it's faith plus works, then for the peace of the church, that's how you need to operate. Is that Galatians chapter 2? I don't think so. Paul wrote him a letter and told him, this is how it is. And this is what you're going to believe. Now, did Paul do that out of unilateral Catholic authority? How did Paul write them with such certainty and say, this is what's true, you will do it? Turn to Acts chapter 15. Acts chapter 15, I'm going to start with verse 1 and then I'm going to skip down to verse 6. But some men came down from Judea and were teaching the brothers, unless you are circumcised according to the custom of Moses, you cannot be saved. So there's this false teaching. It's the same false teaching that bewitched the Galatians, which is that you need to add things to faith in order to be saved. Skip down to verse 6. The apostles and the elders were gathered together to consider this matter. And after there had been much debate, Peter stood up and said to them, and then Peter gives a speech, and then look at Verse 12, and the assembly fell silent, and they listened to Barnabas and Paul as they related. Verse 13, after they finished, James replied, therefore my judgment is, in verse 19, and then they make that decision, and then beginning in verse 22, the council sends out a letter that says this is what the Orthodox Christian faith is. What does the Council of Jerusalem, if you fast forward to our time, what does the Council of Jerusalem sound like? Sounds like a synod meeting, doesn't it? Or a presbytery meeting. All the elders were gathered together. They presented the information. Everybody gets a turn to debate and discuss and think through the issue. And then at the end of the day, they, as a council, decide, this is what we're going to do. And they write the churches and they tell them, this is how it is. Was that done by the unilateral authority of Peter? See, if Peter were truly the great single bishop in the world that Christ had appointed, Peter would have stood up and said, this is how it is because I am Peter. And everybody would have agreed. Yeah, all right, Peter said so. That's what we're going to do. Right? That's not what happened. Peter stood up and said his piece and then looked around and waited for James to say his. Paul spoke. Barnabas spoke. So it's this council of elders, or at that time a council of apostles. So in both the Old Testament and the New Testament, you never see this form of government at play in the church, and you do not see that form of government at play in the church. That general principle of Bible interpretation, okay, just a good rule to know. If God has always acted a certain way, can He decide that He's going to act differently? Absolutely. But the way we interpret the Bible is this. If God is going to change the way He has always worked and told us to work, God is specifically and explicitly going to tell us about that change. That's just a good general principle. You don't reason from silence. Well, God didn't say that this form of government was the only one that's going to continue in the New Testament. It just seems to be what everybody's doing. But since God didn't explicitly say in the New Testament, thou shalt be Presbyterian, then we can be whatever we want to be. It doesn't matter. That argument's used a lot when it comes to worship, isn't it? Arguing from silence. Well, God doesn't say the pastor can't dress up like a monkey to get the point across in his sermon, so clearly it must be acceptable. You think I'm kidding? That's the argument, is that you reason from silence. God didn't prohibit it, so it must be okay. We don't argue that way. If God's always done something, if He's established a pattern, this is how He works, then He's got to explicitly tell us, I'm going to do something different. Or something different is required of you. And then we change. Can you think of an example in the New Testament where that happened? A vision anybody might have had with a blanket coming down? What were God's dietary laws in the Old Testament? They're pretty strict, right? A lot of rules about what you could and couldn't eat. A lot of rules about how it was to be prepared. All kinds of rules about food. If the New Testament was entirely silent on the issue of food, would we or would we not still be under those food laws? We would be. Because you do not argue from silence. But is the New Testament silent on food laws? No. First of all, Jesus gives a big speech about all of the purity requirements of the Old Testament and how they're fulfilled in Him and pass away in Him. But because He knows we're hard-headed, He gives us an even more specific example in Peter's vision, right? Food comes down on a blanket. And it's in parentheses. It's an editorial comment that He gives to us. In doing this, God declared all foods clean. Then we go, oh, okay, good. All foods are clean. I can eat lobster now.
And barbecue.
We'd have a very hard time without shellfish and pork. If there was ever anything that would tempt me to another religion, it would be if I couldn't have shellfish and pork. So we don't argue from silence. Well, the same thing is the case in church government. How has God always acted? Through councils of elders. Always. Old Testament, New Testament, Israel, church. God has always acted through councils of elders. So why would we believe that it's different now? Now, I'm going to have to step on toe a little bit. Why does the ARP Church insist on living hundreds of years behind the curve and demanding that only men hold the office of elder and deacon? Because even if you ignored every text in the New Testament that uses the word man for those offices, even if you said those texts don't prove anything, at best you are left with the argument from silence. Because in the Old Testament, God operated through councils of elders. Israel did not make that choice. God made that choice. And in the New Testament church, God operated through councils of elders and apostles, which were men. And God, Jewish culture in the first century did not make that choice. God made that choice. Jesus pointed at 12 people and said, "Follow me." And so at best, if you want to throw out every verse in the New Testament that says these elders and deacons ought to be men, throw them all out, say that you're worthless, now you're still left with an argument from silence. That God is going to change something that He has always done without telling us. That is a bad way to read the Bible. Not just on that issue, on every issue. You don't argue from silence. So the pattern that we have in the Old Testament and the New is this rule by a council of elders. Now let's ask the bishop question for a minute. The New Testament does use the word bishop. It uses the word shepherd, it uses the word overseer, it uses the word elder, it uses the word bishop. And it seems to many of us that it uses all of those words synonymously. It uses them to refer to the same office. It's just different ways of speaking about it. Do we ever do that with the offices today? What do you call me?
Pastor?
Reverend, minister, am I the shepherd of this flock? Am I the overseer of the flock? Am I one of the elders? I got a lot of titles, don't I? They all refer to the same office. So, just as we do in English, when you study the Greek on this, I think it makes a convincing case that all of those terms refer to the same office. And they're used depending on which aspect of the office the writer is wanting to emphasize. With the episcopal model, you have to argue that the words shepherd, elder, and overseer are synonymous. They all refer to one thing. But the word bishop refers to an elevated office, both in spiritual and in church authority, the office of bishop, and that is a greater office in the New Testament. What happens with the bishop is he becomes a functional pope. At each level. So this particular church has a priest, and this area, geographical area, can have a council of priests, but at the end of the day, the bishop over that area has final authority over that area. Then you can move up to a higher bishop and a higher bishop and a higher bishop. So many of the decisions will be made in terms of a council, but many of them rest just with a bishop. So that's the ecclesiastical or the church government problem. The spiritual problem is that in this model, the bishop actually has greater spiritual authority than any elder or priest. The bishop has the authority to ordain. And the theological problem with that is that you cannot find anywhere in the New Testament where one person has the power to ordain. outside of Jesus. Jesus ordains, and then once Jesus has ordained, those He ordained together have His authority to ordain someone else. I wasn't ordained here. Y'all seen an ordination? In a Presbyterian ordination, all the elders who are present in the building, doesn't matter if they're members of this church, doesn't matter if they're members of this denomination, because we believe that the authority to ordain is handed down from Christ and through elders, plural. And so if you have an ordination here, every elder who's in the building will be asked to come forward and to lay hands on the ordinand. And that's how ordination takes place. It's not by any one person's power or authority. It's by a council of elders rather than one single bishop. That is, just laying my cards on the table, that is my only real beef with this model. In a lot of ways, I like the Episcopal model because it's a Presbyterian model, but it's more effective because what's easier to get done at work? A group project or a task that's entirely yours? We joke about Presbyterians, right? We decide that we want to paint the fellowship hall and we've got to get a committee on paint colors. And then the committee on paint colors has to coordinate with the committee on fellowship halls. And then those two committees can come up with a decision, and that decision still has to go in front of the deacons who have formed the subcommittee on the rising costs of paint. And then that subcommittee meets and decides if we can afford that paint and that paint color. And then that subcommittee reports back to the session who finally gives the approval of, yes, we will go forward with this. Except usually it's no, we need you to find a way to save $25, and then it goes back to the first committee. What's easier, that process or Edwin saying, hey, I think I'll paint the fellowship hall? Goes and buys the paint, comes and paints it. Right? So that's why functionally this becomes very practical and appealing. We can't do things just because they're appealing. American, this is one of the times when I should turn the recorder off, but I'm not going to. Hold on, Phil. What Presbyterianism ought to be is very close to what we think of as this. American Presbyterianism is extremely tainted by American democracy. And so our view that we elected those bums in Washington into office and they're going to be our voice in Washington or we're going to throw their butts out of there, right? That's our mentality. That creeps into the church. And we say, well, they're both representative democracy. The elders represent me in those meetings. And as I look on that elder board, I don't see one that represents me. That's the mentality that creeps in. And the mentality of they have to defend the decisions that they make to us. Not explain, but defend. That's crept into the church. That's not true Presbyterianism. Elders don't represent you. They represent Christ. It's just it. And they don't owe you a defense for anything. Now, a wise session will be judicious in the way that they inform the congregation and explain what's happening. But that's very different than what you see a lot of times in Presbyterian churches now, which is sessions constantly on the stand under accusation for this decision they made or this thing that they did. That's not Presbyterian. So that's why I say what we think of as Episcopal, which is this group of bishops, can you believe they make decisions for the people? The people don't even get a vote? Yeah, I can believe that. That's what the Bible says we ought to do. And even the ARP church government, form of government, has some concessions to American ideals. We're a Presbyterian form of government, except congregations have the right to vote on every single budget that the church passes. There's nothing Presbyterian about that. it's Americanism creeping into Presbyterianism. And it's not the end of the world. It's not a hill worth dying on. But it's just interesting that I think what you see in a lot of people today will look at the Bible and will say, when you see just how much authority those elders exercise, they'll say, boy, it almost looks closer to this. It does. But the difference between this and this, the most important difference between the two, is the spiritual authority of a bishop. And that's where I think Presbyterianism more correctly reflects what the Bible teaches. Phil?
You answered most of my questions.
Oh, okay.
The other part would be, what is the tenure of those officers serving in the different offices?
Life. Okay. You see anybody in the New Testament rotate off of the apostleship? Sorry, James, your 3-year period's over. What in the world? I'm not opposed to elders taking sabbaticals. I'm not opposed to elders stepping down because of other commitments and things like that. Personal decisions have to be made about their involvement. A forced cycle of rotation, what we call a rotating session, is something entirely foreign to the Bible. Now, I understand why people do them. Don't get me wrong. As the moderator of multiple sessions now in my life, I completely understand the appeal of having some people automatically rotate off. You don't have to ask them to step down. You don't have to throw them off. If you can just wait 7 more months, he rotates off. I get that appeal. I just don't think that appeal is, you know, grounded in the New Testament. So,
congregationalism is an ultimate extension.
Whew! This is... Well, and we don't have time for a history lecture today. This is what the American form of government has become. The idea of ballot initiatives. What? California has a prop, whatever, on every election they have. And that's where the entire population of the state, or the entire voting population of the state, gets to make a decision that binds the hands of the lawfully elected representatives. That is not democracy. Or representative democracy, at least.
But our original founding fathers apparently liked the Presbyterian.
They did. We had a tricameral system. Boy, we are going to get off into history here.
Sorry.
Why do we have a House of Representatives and a Senate?
The House of Representatives represents the people. The Senate represents the states until the 17th Amendment destroyed them.
Did you know that the reason we had two houses was because the House of Representatives represents the people? They're the populace voice. They listen to what the people tell them to do, and they do it. And that's why the numbers of that representation reflect the size of your state. So California gets more people in the House of Representatives than North Dakota. It's more people. They should have a louder voice. The Senate, where everybody is represented equally by two voices, was supposed to represent the interests not of the people, but of the state. The state of South Dakota has slightly different interests than the people of South Dakota. And so those two houses would represent different interests. That's why the only person who could elect a senator prior to the 17th Amendment was a state representative. So it was the state representatives of South Dakota, not the people, who elected the senators of South Dakota. Everybody was represented equally. Well, now that both houses are elected by the people and are the voices of the people, it makes no sense to have both houses. It makes absolutely no sense. It's my American government post-17th Amendment tirade. Edwin knows how to stir up trouble. But really, a lot of that has crept into church government. This view that the voice of the vox populi, vox dei, the voice of the people is the voice of God. No. The voice of God is the voice of God. And God has declared that he will express his voice in the local church through councils of ordained and called elders. And that's why when you search in a congregation for somebody to fill the office of deacon, or to fill the office of elder, or to fill the office of minister of the word, you are not simply looking for someone who is qualified. You are also looking for someone who is called. You've got to have both of those sides if you're going to hear the voice of God through those bodies. All right, so that is part of what it means to be Presbyterian, is that we practice this particular form of representative democracy in our church government. Any questions about that aspect before we move on to a couple of other aspects of Presbyterianism? Yes?
Is the Anglican Church, do they use the Episcopal form of government?
Mm-hmm. The Methodist Church uses the Episcopal form of government as well. And there's good Anglicans. I shouldn't say good and bad. There are like-minded Anglicans to us, and there are differently-minded Anglicans to us. The what is it now? It used to be the AMA, the Anglican Mission in America, and CANA, the Communion of Anglicans in North America. But now it's not. Now it's the AM, the Anglican Mission, which is all the conservative American Anglicans in one sort of denomination, but they call them communions. They're under the Archbishop of Rwanda because he's faithful to the Bible and the Archbishop of North America is not. But if you went into an AM church, an Anglican Mission church, it would take you weeks to find something that was different than what we do. Really, it wouldn't be until the bishop showed up that you'd see that something is a little different from what we do. So.
Well, even if you watch the wedding of
Kate. Right.
I mean, the service was pretty orthodox.
Yes. Yep. The Anglican Church still has the good documents. They still read the right things, have the good liturgy. I mean, even the liberal Anglican Church still has that compared with the liberal Presbyterian Church, which rewrites everything. Like this week when they decided to rewrite. I looked at the phrase that they're all worked up about. It says that people called to ministerial office will practice, sexual fidelity within marriage and maintain sexual purity outside of marriage. That's the sentence. And it's horribly offensive to the Presbyterian Church USA. So they have struck it out from their documents. How dare you tell people that they ought to be sexually pure outside of marriage? What century do you think we're living in? All right, something else that makes Presbyterians Presbyterians is that we're a people of standards. We are governed by standards. We are the opposite of no creed but Christ. We couldn't be any further from that statement. We got so many standards. Now, all of our standards, we would argue, are based on what Christ did and taught. But we are people of standards. What are some examples of standards? The Westminster Confession of Faith. The Westminster Larger Catechism. The Westminster Shorter Catechism. We've got the creeds. The Apostles and the Nicene. What else? What standards are specific to the ARP? The Blue Book. You seen the blue three-ring binder? We call that the Blue Book. It's the ARP. It has the form of government. It has the Book of Discipline. And it has the Directory for Public Worship. Those are standards of this denomination. The form of government tells us how we keep the trains running on time. You want to start a church? How do you start a church? You want to ordain an elder? How do you ordain an elder? You want to call a pastor? How do you call a pastor? Form of government. The Book of Discipline. When you need to exercise church discipline in a church, how do you do that? If you need to have a trial, how's a trial going to be conducted? What's the purpose of discipline? All that's in the Book of Discipline. The Directory for Public Worship. What are the acceptable boundaries for worship? What is the purpose of worship and how should it be conducted? Both on a weekly basis and in special services. What are the rules for a wedding in an ARP church? What's allowed in an ARP funeral? Directory for Public Worship. These things set the boundaries for what is allowed. And so these are our standards. We start with the creeds, Apostles' Nicene. The Westminster Confession of Faith is a theological standard, along with the larger and the shorter catechisms. And then we have our governmental standards, the form of government, the Book of Discipline, and the Directory for Public Worship. And then subordinate to that, it's funny, these abbreviations that we have in the ARP. We have the FOG and the MAD. The Manual of Authorities and Duties is really granular. How does a committee operate? How does this committee do its business? But those are our standards, and we have lots of them. What's the purpose of standards? Why would standards be a good thing?
Guardrails.
Keeps people from doing whatever they want to do all the time. What else?
Direction of organization.
Tells you how to run the place. That's helpful.
Consistency.
Ah, consistency. Consistency. Every ARP church is going to be affirming the same theological truths. Every ARP church, theoretically, is going to be submitted to the same set of governmental standards. This is how we're going to operate. That kind of consistency is very important. Consistency is underrated. Questions about standards, why we have them, or our particular standards? Clearly, this is the most exciting part of the class, right? All right, last thing. We'll wrap this up, what it means to be Presbyterianism. What's that? Like all decisions, it rests with the council of elders. At some point at this church, I'm sure we will do a study together of the confession. I imagine you've done some studies on that before, looking at how the confession came about and what it teaches and why it's important. But those standards are set by the General Synod, which is the final part of the hierarchy, the topmost government. Are you represented? Is this congregation represented at the General Synod? Yes, you have a pastor and you have an elder who's there. Is your voice heard as much as the voice of First Presbyterian Columbia, South Carolina, with its thousands of members? Your voice is equally heard. Actually, your voice is probably heard a little more loudly because your pastor's a little louder. Chide Dr. Ferguson about his Presbyterianism. All right, one other stamp of what it means to be Presbyterian. So we've said it means that you have a certain form of government. It means that you're a people of standards. It also means you're committed to what we call the means of grace. Ask yourself a question. How does God communicate grace to His people? How does God give His people all the things that He gives them as an act of grace? Well, what does God give as an act of grace? Well, God gives wisdom. He gives comfort. He gives peace. He gives joy. He gives, insert all the fruits of the Spirit. Right. These are things that God gives to His people, right? How does He communicate these things to His people? Well, we would say He does it through the means of grace. And that even begins with salvation itself. God communicates these things in particular ways. The means of grace gets back to... Well, let's say this another way. If this is how God communicates these things to His people, whatever these means are, if that's how you get this stuff, would we all agree this stuff is good? We would all agree that Christians want to get this, right? What do you think a worship service should be centered on? How do we get these things? Seem reasonable enough? If worship is a two-way activity, if God's up here and we're down here, worship goes two ways, right? We communicate something to God, praise, petitions, thanksgiving. But worship's not just that one way, is it? What we do on Sundays is bigger than just us saying things to God or about God. No, God promises that He'll meet with us. God promises that He'll send His Spirit God promises that through the preaching of the Word, people will come to know Christ as Lord. God promises that all Word is God-breathed and profitable for reproof, for correction, for training in righteousness, that the man of God may be equipped to do every good work. Isn't that what God says? So worship services ought to be about doing the things through which God communicates His grace. So then you've got to go through the Bible and find out what kind of things does the Bible specifically say God will use to communicate His grace? Well, what are they? Most especially preaching. What else? Sacraments. What else?
We sing the Word.
Ah, singing of songs, hymns, and spiritual songs.
Prayer.
Prayer. And really, singing is a type of prayer, isn't it? And I'd argue, according to the Bible, that's about it. Those are the things the Bible explicitly says God will bless every single time. These are done faithfully. God will communicate grace through them. The Bible says. So then we go back to the question of, if these are the things that God promises to bless, if these are the things that God commands of us, doesn't He command these things? What should fill up our worship service? These things. Should it be things that God's silent on? Things that may or may not be useful? When you're committed to the means of grace, you're going to be accused of being against a lot of things. That's just part of what happens. Oh, you're against. That's usually how the sentences start. So, I love paintings. I love art, visual art. Part of the reason why I love it is because I am so inept at it. You all have noticed my ragged stick figures. I am not, in any means, an artist. And so I really appreciate going to an art museum, seeing paintings. Paintings can communicate beautiful truth. There's tremendous value in that kind of art. So doesn't it stand to reason then that we should have in the front of our church during the worship service an artist who is painting during the service so that we can be blessed and receive benefit from that artistic expression as a part of our worship? Doesn't that seem reasonable? Lots of churches do it. I went to churches in Charlotte that did it. And you see the line of reasoning that they take. Just because something is good, just because something is useful, just because something has value in one context, does not make it appropriate for a worship context. We do the things that God explicitly commands. We do the things that God has promised to bless. These things will bring the most guaranteed benefit for the most people within a worship service. And then stuff that might be good. Well, you know, I really sense the power of God and see the majesty of His creation when I'm outdoors. We ought to start having church outdoors. There's nothing wrong with having church outdoors. But is that where the center of your focus needs to be? It needs to be on this. Whether you're indoors or out, it needs to be on this. It doesn't need to be on thinking of how can I creatively change what God has commanded or add to what God has commanded. A couple examples in the Bible where people got creative with worship. Do you remember the story of Nadab and Abihu? They were in charge of certain aspects of the worship that God had commanded. And they decided one day, and I'm not exaggerating, I'm telling you the story. They decided one day they were going to get creative. And they were going to bring, in addition to the other stuff they were supposed to bring, they were going to bring into worship fire that the Lord had not commanded. He said, you know what, we're going to set up some candles around on the windowsill. This will be good. This will help people. worship God more faithfully. And what happened? Toast. Israel decided one time that Moses was the visual representative of God for them, and Moses had been gone for several weeks, and they didn't know if Moses was ever coming back. And they knew that Yahweh was the true God, because after all, Yahweh had brought them out of slavery in Egypt, but they just couldn't see Yahweh's representative anymore. They were having a hard time feeling emotionally involved in worship with Moses gone. And so they said, you know what we're going to do? We're going to melt down all this gold and we're going to build ourselves a calf. And Aaron's going to hold up the calf and says, "Hear, O Israel, this is Yahweh. This is the God who brought you out of Egypt." Now, do you really think they believe that that golden calf that they had just made is the God that freed them from Egypt? No. They just thought it would help them to experience worship better if they could see something that represented God. How'd that end for them? Not well. You melt it, you put it in the river, and you make them drink it, and they fall over dead. God's not interested in your creativity in worship. That's what we mean when we say we are committed to the means of grace. It does not mean we're against art. It does not mean that we're against the outdoors. It does not mean that we think God's trapped in some little box and can only be worshipped the way that we decide He can be worshipped. No, it means that God, for the sake of worship, has put Himself in a box. And He has said, "These are the things I will bless. These are the things you must do." Don't get creative. You get creative on your own time. That's your time for creativity. Corporate worship is about the means of grace, because we are certain that we have access to God through them.